Prologue. Cambridge, 2004. "Vampire? Fact or fiction?" announced Megan grandly. An undergrad reading Kant in German raised a brow and went back to her critique of pure reason. The tourists at the table next to us edged their plastic chairs ever so slightly towards the other side, bumping into a potted plant in the process. "So you've picked a title, then?" I said. Megan shrugged. "It's a little over the top, but I thought, why not? It's almost Halloween, after all." So it was. I'd been back in the U.S. for nearly 3 months now. We'd gone from the sticky heat of late August in Cambridge, the campus deserted except for the sleepy flies on the windowsills and a handful of stressed-out grad students in their carols at Widener Library, to the Indian summer of September, when bewildered freshmen roamed the streets in defensive herds, turning up at the wrong buildings and crowding the tables at Au Bon Pain. It was October now. The freshmen had settled into their dorms, the upperclassmen were out and about, belatedly buying their course books at the co-op and arguing loudly about existentialism in the upstairs room of Café Algiers. Summer seemed like a very long time ago. Sometimes as I scurried from Widener to Robinson Hall, books clutched in one arm, a Vietnamese coffee from Toscanini's dripping on the other, it seemed hard to believe that I had ever left, had ever spent a year in England, had ever lived, albeit temporarily, in a Georgian manor in Sussex with an Englishman named Colin. It sounds like something out of a chick flick, doesn't it? Take one American graduate student on her research year in England, wearing reasonably cute boots, add a set of family archives, and the handsome but mysterious owner thereof, cue dramatic music. Of course, in real life, it was all a great deal more prosaic than that. Admittedly, when I'd first met Colin, he'd done his best to impersonate Mr. Rochester, if Rochester had been blonde and given to wearing an ancient barber jacket. Despite those impediments, Colin had managed to brood quite forbiddingly when I'd requested access to his family archives. He was rather protective of the family heritage, which contained a truly dramatic number of undercover agents. There was a time when I'd wondered if Colin might be one himself. But I was over that now, mostly. In any case, the only agents of whom I was officially on the trail were all 2 centuries gone. My mission was to winkle out their escapades and turn them into footnotes in my dissertation, "Aristocratic Espionage During the Wars with France, 1789 to 1815. With enough academies, even swashbuckling spies can be rendered dry as dust. But that was just a front. The truth of the matter was that my interest had long since become less about the dissertation and more a personal involvement with the people whose escapades I was reconstructing, piecemeal, from a sometimes conflicting array of documents. I was meant to be studying all 3 of the major British spy leagues, the Scarlet Pimpernel, the Purple Gentian, and the Pink Carnation. But my interest had come to focus more and more narrowly on the Pink Carnation. I could find all sorts of ways to justify it. The Carnation was in operation much longer and therefore made a better case study. The League had experimented with different techniques and methods, which told us something about the evolution of aristocratic spying from an ad hoc endeavor to a quasi-professional enterprise. And, of course, the Carnation was a woman. One Miss Jane Wollaston, who, with the help of her erstwhile chaperone, Miss Gwendolyn Meadows, had hoodwinked Napoleon for close on a decade. It was so simple that it was genius. Who would suspect a demure lady of society to be fronting the most audacious undercover enterprise since Odysseus came up with the bright idea of knocking a few wooden slats together and calling them a horse? At least, that was how the League of the Pink Carnation had operated during the first